Президенты России и Франции подвели
итоги. Большие российско-французские переговоры, самые
масштабные.
Президенты
России и Франции проводят переговоры.
Путин пригласил Макрона в Россию с ответом.
French President Emmanuel Macron reads Vladimir Putin the Riot Act in public. An increasingly confident Angela Merkel rides high in the polls, looks to be sailing towards a fourth term as German Chancellor, and there appears to be little the Kremlin can do about it. After the Euro crisis, the migrant crisis, the rise of the xenophobic right, and a coordinated campaign of Russian meddling, it looks to many that with Merkel and Macron at the helm, Europe is getting its mojo back. Is it real, or is it a false dawn? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is Jamie Kirchick, author of the recently published book, The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age, which we will be discussing today. Welcome to the podcast, Jamie. Congratulations on a great and timely book.
Hey, thank you.
Thanks for coming. And also joining us from Washington, D.C. is Christian Carl, a columnist for The Washington Post and author of the book Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century. Welcome to the podcast, Christian.
Hi.
Hi.
Good to see you.
So Jamie, as the title of your book suggests, which incidentally was published on my birthday, I just happened to notice that when I was looking it up yesterday, it paints a pretty bleak picture. The Western liberal model embodied by the European Union is under assault and on its heels. Populism and xenophobia is on the rise, and the Kremlin is exploiting the crisis masterfully. The future, at least in the short term to medium term, belongs to autocrats like Vladimir Putin. To get the ball rolling, I'll hand the mic over to you to basically summarize the book's thesis for those who haven't read it, and shame on them. But just for their benefit, if you could basically spell out your main arguments and supporting points, if you would.
Sure. Well, the book has 8 chapters, and each one looks at a different country and examines a particular crisis in Europe through the prism of those countries. So I look at everything from the Eurozone crisis to the rise of illiberal democracy in Hungary, to strategic neutrality in Germany and Brexit and so on and so forth. And I think all these crises are being exacerbated by the new government we have now in Washington, which in the form of Donald Trump appears to be at best apathetic, if not openly antagonistic to what Europe is.
Sticking with you, Jamie, when you wrote this book, the Western world was reeling from what was a very, very, very rough 2016 and looking ahead with a lot of trepidation towards 2017. But elections in Austria, the Netherlands, and most significantly in France appear, in the eyes of many, to be turning the tide. Optimists are now saying that the Merkel-Macron partnership can keep Europe together and keep Putin and Putinism at bay in Europe. Would you change anything if you were writing this book today?
Not necessarily. No one was really seriously predicting that Geert Wilders was going to become prime minister in the Netherlands or that Marine Le Pen was going to win the French election.
Although many were predicting Fillon would win the French election, which would have been a kind of a pro-Moscow government there.
Yes. In fact, 3 of the 4 candidates in the French presidential election were pretty much openly pro-Putin, which is a kind of disturbing factor, I would say. But no, I think that the conditions that create these illiberal political forces are still present in Europe. If you look at, you know, the high unemployment in France, which is, I think, a major contributor to why not only Marine Le Pen, but also the far left candidate, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, also got a lot of support. That's still a problem. And also Islamic terrorism and Islamism is not going away anytime soon. And that's another driver of far-right political parties. So I don't think we're out of the woods yet. I think it's a little complacent to say that just because Emmanuel Macron won and just because, Geert Wilders was prevented from getting more seats than he might have gotten in another scenario, I think that's a little bit too optimistic.
Although looking ahead to the German elections, doesn't that give you a little bit of a cause for optimism there?
It does, although I wouldn't say right now whether or not. Well, I mean, it depends on what you think. I mean, I would support Chancellor Merkel winning. Her opponent, Martin Schulz, is not some sort of demagogue. So if he were to somehow win, It's not like it would be the end of the Atlantic Alliance in Germany. What I'm concerned about in Germany, though, is a sort of longer drift towards a more, you know, neutral position between the United States and Russia. And I think, you know, having someone like Donald Trump in the White House gives support to those in Germany who would want to pursue that path. So, and I also, in terms of the election itself, you know, the Russians are sitting on a pretty fat pile of information that they stole from the Bundestag in the summer of 2015, which they hacked. And we don't know what they're going to do with that information. I suspect that the Russians are trying to make Merkel the Hillary Clinton of 2017. They're already doing that. They have been doing that really over the past year and a half. But I think there's still a few months left, and they might have something up their sleeve.
Mm. Christian, let's bring you into the conversation. What are your thoughts on this? Is Jamie's obituary for Europe premature here? Is Putinism still winning?
Well, I actually happen to think that Jamie's on exactly the right track. I think the thing that frightens me the most is a general sense of complacency among European leaders. They keep talking the same technocratic way. They keep giving lip service to the idea that the European Union needs more democracy on the European level. They keep giving lip service to reforms, but they don't actually seem to be doing much except kind of sneering at Donald Trump, which is entirely understandable, but I fear a great way of distracting themselves from the incredibly serious problems that they face. As far as the German election goes, I think we often tend to view these things much too narrowly, right? As Jamie was pointing out, there is not a gigantic ideological gap between the two candidates in the German election. But imagine if, as Jamie were saying, Putin managed to use this material to sway the result of the election. And imagine if he were able to show that Russia had somehow had a hand in that, even if he denied it vociferously. That would give Russia again the image of being a player, of being able to reach great distances and mess things up, muddle things. That's what Putin wants. Mm-hmm. He's not even trying to get his ideological allies into power. I mean, he is trying to do that. But even if he doesn't, you know, he had a vendetta against Hillary Clinton. And he didn't necessarily think that he was going to get Trump in as the winner of the election. He wanted to make life hell for Hillary Clinton. He succeeded. So that makes him look like a player. And that's what he wants.
No, I would agree with you there that his goal is not so much to elect specific leaders, but to create doubt in the veracity of our democratic institutions. And he certainly was, to a degree, successful with that in the United States. The elections in France, not just the result, but the fact that Putin hacked that and was unable to get either of the things he wanted, neither the candidate nor the chaos and doubt in institutions, this election has seemed to, if anything, kind of bolstered liberalism, bolstered and bolstered confidence in France. And it did that in a situation. And yes, Le Pen got two or three times as many votes as her father. I get that. But the fact of the matter is that in this environment, Emmanuel Macron won that election running on an unapologetic pro-European, Europhile, pro-Atlanticist ticket. And he won 2/3 of the vote. And that, I think that says something. And I'm wondering if the French election didn't change the trajectory of this. No?
Well,
go ahead, Jamie.
As you can tell from the title of my book, I tend to take a glass half empty approach to things. And so I'll give you the pessimistic interpretation. I mean, if you just look at there were polls done of people who voted for Macron in the second round, and a much larger portion of people voting for him were doing so to vote against Marine Le Pen rather than because they were embracing his agenda. So he was quite lucky that he had her in the final round. There was no way that she was going to win in a two-way race. So that's the cause for pessimism. On the other hand, you know, his press conference with Putin a few days ago was very gratifying to those of us, and I would include all three of us, who have been, you know, harping on the issue of Russian disinformation for years. And to finally see a Western leader confront Putin and say to his face that RT and Sputnik are not journalistic institutions, but propaganda instruments, and to do so very eloquently and strongly was very gratifying.
Yeah, no, Putin, as Christopher Dickey wrote in the Daily Beast, looked like he wanted to crawl behind the curtains at Versailles. Yes, that was gratifying and a little bit surprising to see a 39-year-old, freshly inaugurated president take on this 64-year-old KGB veteran in public, and it seemed to say there's a new game afoot now. It seemed to say to me. I mean, I'm an optimist by nature. I can't help it. So I'm always looking to find ways to see the glass half full. But I take your pessimism. I'm gonna stick with you a minute, Jamie, in terms of one of the themes that kind of went through the book, is that this notion of Putin trying to make Russia great again and Germany afraid to be great again. Could you elaborate on that? Because that was one of the big takeaways that I had in the book. And I'm wondering, again, if this isn't something that's changing, given Angela Merkel's comments this week.
Yeah, well, so there's definitely a theme of German neutrality, which I really trace back. You could go back hundreds of years, but I trace it back to the Cold War period. And people forget how difficult it was for, you know, Konrad Adenauer, the post-war chancellor, to really anchor Germany in the West and in NATO. It was a very controversial decision. Many Germans wanted to have some form of neutrality and unification on Joseph Stalin's terms. The biggest protests in post-war Germany were those in the early 1980s against the deployment of nuclear-tipped NATO missiles in West Germany. And I trace it all the way up to the current day with the Edward Snowden scandal, which I really see as being a very clever, crafty attempt by the Russians to stir up anti-American sentiment in Germany. This is something that I'm acutely worried about. And I actually have to give credit to Merkel. I think that, you know, Trump puts her in a very difficult position because she's a very pro-American Atlanticist leader. And so she's had to thread this very careful needle where she has to distance herself from Trump. But she's also, as I said, pro-American. She doesn't want to appear anti-American. She doesn't want to do what Gerhard Schroeder did with George W. Bush and run on a real kind of explicitly anti-American campaign. And I think she's done that quite well. She's sort of harnessed this very deep German disgust and suspicion with Donald Trump. And she's moved it in a more, I would say, maybe pro-European direction. But as far as Russia is concerned, look, the Germans are very divided about how to approach Russia. There's a great degree of fear about Russia in Germany. There's still a degree of, you could even say, you know, post-World War II guilt about Russia, which the Russians have exploited very masterfully over the Ukraine crisis. And I think this will be a big question in the coming years is, you know, is Germany going to assume a bigger leadership role in confronting Russia? I mean, Germans are very hesitant to embrace anything that smacks of leadership. And I personally think they need to kind of get over it. It's, you know, 70 years on from World War II. Most Europeans want Germany to spend more on their defense. So I think it's time for them to step up.
Now, I see actually right now Germany showing a lot of leadership, and I see a little bit of change in these German attitudes. I would agree with you that historically this has been the German position. But I think something happened after the annexation of Crimea that really changed the game quite a bit. For the Germans, the annexation, the first annexation of another country's territory since the Second World War is a big deal, a big expletive deleted deal, as Joe Biden would say. And you're seeing in the polls anti-Russian sentiment rising in Germany to an extent because of this. As far as the war guilt, and I'm starting to see pieces in the German media saying the war guilt shouldn't be just the Russians shouldn't be the only beneficiaries of this. Proportionally, right. The Ukrainians, yes, lost a lot more to the Nazis, as did the Belarusians. And Merkel is showing kind of leadership vis-a-vis Russia. She certainly is. And it's not costing her in the polls at all. In fact, she's rising steadily in the polls. The latest polls I'm looking at, she might be able to govern with the Free Democrats and without the SDP. I see Christian wants to jump into the conversation here, so I'm going to hand the mic over to him.
Yeah, I just want to say that when you talk to Germans, as I do relatively frequently, a very important strain of the public thinking comes out that I don't think necessarily gets discussed enough. Yeah, war guilt, that's a very, very complicated emotion that cuts a lot of ways. The very palpable strain of thinking that I always encounter, though, is can be described as fear of war.
Mm. Yeah. It's
extremely deep-seated. The yeah. European idea is extremely powerful in Germany and in France and in other parts of the European Union. We're not denying that at all. But if you can convince Germans that Russia is the peace-loving force and that Russia doesn't want any war, or alternately, if you can convince them Russia is the crazy bear that might do something insane if you provoke them too much, you can actually get, you know, you could actually shift quite a lot of German public opinion. And that sentiment is latent there all the time. And it's something that the Alternative für Deutschland has capitalized on. It's something that a lot of various forces have capitalized on. So I think it's something we don't want to discount too much.
Although the evidence for the crazy bear for the German public seems to be pretty prevalent lately. I mean, from the Lisa case last year to the meddling in the German the meddling in the French and German, what appears to be meddling in the German elections, appears to be moving public opinion on this. I haven't seen any recent polls, but the last Pew poll I saw on Global Attitudes showed a surprisingly high level of anti-Russian sentiment in Germany, certainly high for Germany.
Well, that is, I mean, that's encouraging. It shows a certain degree of realism, but I think I would look at polling figures on the other thing as well. I think Germans' willingness, for example, you know, we just had the German foreign minister over here recently for a visit, and he was talking about how he was sneering at the idea that they were going to raise defense spending to the NATO suggested level simply because Germans, why would they want to spend that much money on the military? Just unthinkable. You know, there was this kind of sense that no matter what happens, you know, they're not going there. And that seemed to me a very typical example of this denialism in action.
Although, what did you make of Merkel's comments earlier this week where she made this comment that we really can't count on America right now, so we have to rely on ourselves? Was this a sea change? No? Go ahead, Christian. Did you want to?
Well, no, Jamie. I think
Jamie, go ahead.
I think you know, they were very important comments. I think they were slightly blown out of proportion. She qualified that statement very clearly. She said we cannot fully rely on not only the United States but also Great Britain as well after Brexit. To the extent that we have in the past. So, you know, Merkel's very deliberate. Everything she says is very considered. She's the complete opposite of Trump. She's not impulsive, at least in her rhetoric. And so I think that, you know, she's been saying stuff like this for quite a long time now, which is that the Europeans need to, you know, buck up and take more responsibility for their own place in the world. On the other hand, it was worrisome to see that she felt the need to say something like this. Which is rather obvious after what she endured over the past couple of months from Donald Trump.
I think it was pretty calculated, actually, though.
Yeah, and she also has, yeah, absolutely. And she has to, you know, she has her own domestic political considerations here. I mean, you saw that speech by Martin Schulz, the head of the Social Democrats, who was basically, you know, rising up to defend the honor of Chancellor Merkel, who represents all the German people. And he decried Trump as acting like an authoritarian leader. So she's in this, you know, she's in this very careful, difficult position where she's being, you know, criticized on the left for being too close to Trump. And so she has to. I don't envy the position that she's in. I'll put it that way.
Jamie, sticking with you, and I want to bring you both in this. I was at the Globsec Bratislava Forum last week, and in one of the side events, a poll, they unveiled a poll that Globsec had done in Bulgaria, Croatia, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, Romania, and Slovakia. So basically, Central and Eastern Europe. And this poll had some surprising results, to say the least. For example, in Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Hungary, Vladimir Putin has a higher rating than Angela Merkel. Now, in some countries, this is a huge gap. In Bulgaria, it's 70 to 39%. In some places, it's closer. In the Czech Republic, it's 32 to 21. Slovakia, it's 41 to 19. Hungary, 44 to 38. But in all of these cases, in each of these countries, Putin has a higher rating than Merkel. Now, Jamie, with you, you did research in a lot of these countries for your book. Is there any what can you add? Can you put a little context around these numbers for me? Because I found them pretty shocking.
It's it's really remarkable that in these countries that once lived under, you know, brute Soviet domination, that you now have major portions of the population expressing a more sympathetic attitude towards Russia than an EU ally and partner like Germany. And I think what this shows is that over the past couple of years, Russia has been very good at inserting this narrative into our discourse, which is that, you know, Islam or Islamism is the major threat to the West, and Russia is an ally in confronting this threat. And you see this, I think it's most remarkable in a place like Hungary, where a leader like Viktor Orban, who really got his, he started his career as a, as an, you know, as an anti-Soviet liberal calling for the removal of Soviet troops, who's now become Vladimir Putin's, you know, strongest ally and advocate within the EU. And a lot of it, I think, centers around this question of Islam and migration. And Russia has been able to portray themselves in the minds of many people in Central and Eastern Europe as being on their side when it comes to the question of national identity. And they portray Merkel as being this sort of harridan, as this devil woman who wants to destroy their countries through ceaseless, you know, importation of Muslim immigrants. And if I had to pinpoint, you know, one reason for why the polls are showing these attitudes, I think that's it.
Mm-hmm. No, and you hear this again and again when you talk to EU officials, the debate about the threat from the south versus the threat from the east, as if they were two mutually exclusive things. Christian, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, well, I just want to say I agree with what Jamie's saying. I think there's also the factor that, of course, Germany is a huge economic presence in all the countries that you've named. So there's always this contradiction between Germany's very benign statements of intent and its factual economic dominance throughout this whole region. And I think very often you get this problem where people are kind of reacting against the devil they know or they think they know, you know, the big dominant German thing, and seeing Putin, who, of course, is a bit more distant, a bit more of a vague presence, as someone who might be a useful ally against that German dominance. But certainly the dominant thing is exactly what Jamie was talking about.
Now, another set of numbers in this poll, in this GlobeSec poll, and in another poll that was also released last week by the Beacon Project together with IRI and NED. According to the GlobeSec poll, in Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic, pluralities say their countries, and this is remarkable, their countries are not part of the West or the East, but somewhere in between. I mean, I would like, you know, the Prague happens to be to the west of Vienna, by the way, you know, if we're talking about geography here, right? But in Hungary, 53% believe this in-betweenism, this neutrality, if you will, between the east and the west. In Slovakia, it's 42%, Czech Republic, 41%. Moreover, in the Beacon Project poll, majorities in all four Visegrad countries, Slovakia, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland, support neutrality. Which is, again, another, and I made a comment at the time. I was like, I don't know what people think about, what mean when they say neutrality. Do they have some fuzzy image of the Swiss Alps and chocolate and nice watches? Because this is, it's just very odd to me when you're looking at, I mean, the way I see the struggle in Europe is between two normative systems. One that's based on the rule of law and the rights of the individual and the subordination of the authorities to the law, and one that's based on cronyism and corruption and the subordination of the law to the authorities. I don't know how one can conceivably be neutral in that argument. I just don't get it. But Jamie, anything, again, anything in your research of the book that gives shed some light on this?
Well, I think two things. One is I think that we were very complacent and just sort of assuming that, you know, in 1989, that all the peoples of Central and Eastern Europe were basically like Václav Havel. And I remember, you know, moving to Prague in 2010 to work at RFE, and I had this very kind of starry-eyed notion of what the Czech Republic was. And it was really confronted by reality, which is that the country is really, it's more Václav Klaus and Zeman than it is hovel. And so I think a lot of us in the West had this sort of, you know, a very misplaced understanding of what these countries were and the pull that that nationalism and ethnic nationalism and parochialism had over the populations. And second, you know, you described two normative systems, and that's absolutely true. But there's also the question of values. And I think many people in this part of the world have been convinced that the West or the EU represents values like the degradation of the family and homosexuality and the disappearance of national identity and neoliberalism, which is this sort of, you know, catch-all term for, you know, rampant and rapacious capitalism. Whereas Russia is proposing alternative values like the traditional family and the nation state and sovereignty. And I think that they've been quite good, and they have people, they have leaders like, you know, again, Viktor Orban, who basically make the same arguments. And they attack the EU as representing these values that are alien and foreign to us. And so I think that that's something that we can't overlook as well.
But I think there's a counterpoint, and this gave me my necessary dose of optimism, is that in all of these countries in these polls, it shows that the majorities favor liberal democracy, majorities favor staying in the EU, and pluralities and, right, or two majorities favor NATO. So yet there's this real disconnect here that I see in there. Christian, maybe you could shed some light on that.
Well, actually, you know, the political scientists have been digging into this a lot, and Francis Fukuyama here in the States has been particularly eloquent about this. A lot of this comes back to a very stark divide between urban and rural populations. It's one of the most fundamental political divides in the United States, and all over the European Union it is as well. You get this contrast between, you know, to be very crude about it, you know, cosmopolitan, more liberal urban populations, mm-hmm. and then people out in the countryside who see these immigrants going by and they don't know what to make of it. It's very upsetting. They're deeply conflicted. And it's to people like that that, you know, the kind of Russian template that Jamie's referring to can be very effective with. I think there's some very deep societal divides that still exist throughout Europe that you can see reflected in all this.
But how about this disconnect? We're saying we favor liberal democracy, yet we favor Putin over Merkel. We want to stay in the EU, yet they're taking away our traditional values. Go ahead.
Well, again, you mentioned the word neutrality, and this is a word with, you know, a very strong military component as well. And again, all the things that Jamie said about the competing value systems are absolutely relevant. But if you're talking about neutrality, that's the idea: are we willing to fight on mm-hmm. the side of NATO or not? And at a time when the West was very strong and, you know, was clearly the way to go, that might have been a much easier decision for some of these Central European populations to make. At a time when Russia is much more ascendant and much more aggressive, indeed, the possibility of an actual fighting war increases. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that gives people pause in these countries, even if they feel some kind of instinctive attachment mm-hmm. to Western values. Mm-hmm. You know, the enhanced forward presence of NATO in the Baltics, I haven't seen the figures lately, but last time I checked popular opinion polls, there was almost no majority for that in any NATO country I could find. I mean, pretty much every Western European population I saw was very, very nervous about that, because, again, they thought it would provoke the crazy bear, lead to some kind of military action. And you know, I get where they're coming. I don't agree with that, but I can see why they'd be nervous about it.
Yeah, no, I the GlobeSec poll also showed that majorities in all of these countries, the seven countries they polled, Bulgaria, Croatia, Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, Romania, and Slovakia, they see NATO as important for their security. They support NATO, but only Poland, Romania, and Croatia of all those countries favor hosting NATO facilities. And I think that's
significant. There you go.
Now, there are NATO facilities now in Poland. Now, Jamie, you and I were just up in Estonia, and we haven't talked about the Baltics are kind of an outlier in this. I always love going to Estonia or any of the Baltic states, because all of this Euroskeptic angst that you feel elsewhere on the continent is conspicuously absent. You see Estonians are as unapologetic and unashamed Europhiles, and it's just it's a breath of fresh air there. Would you agree that this is a different Europe?
Absolutely. And I'm continually impressed by those countries, especially Estonia. And I think that, you know, anyone who sort of doubts the goodness of the European project or what the real purpose of NATO is should pay a visit to a country like Estonia, where they're very kind of clear-headed about not only the threat from the East, which is on their doorstep, but also the benefits of European integration. It's for me, it's the reason why the most offensive comment of the 2016 presidential campaign, you know, it wasn't anything Donald Trump said about women or immigrants. It was what Newt Gingrich said about not defending Estonia, which most people don't remember that comment, but it was to me. Yeah, well, we do, but most people don't. And to me, that was really one of the worst things that was said. Yeah.
It's also geographically inaccurate. I used to live in St. Petersburg and would often go to Estonia for the weekend. And you have to take an overnight train to get from St. Petersburg to Estonia. And I don't know any, no matter how sprawling the metropolis, I don't know any city that you have to take an overnight train to get to one of its suburbs. I think that's stating the obvious, but I thought it was worth saying.
Well, of course, Gingrich is one of the masters of superficial geographical knowledge.
One thing I wanted to hit on before we move on to the second part, we're going to talk about kind of where Putin goes from here, is this is something I keep coming back to. When I'm on my optimistic days, I say I'm old enough to remember the 70s. We've seen this before. We went through this period of angst. We all remember the 70s, right? When it looked like the West was
on its
feet. Maybe you don't. Christian and I definitely remember the 70s. Jamie, you don't remember the 70s.
Jamie's
remember
young and fresh.
But I, in my optimistic times, I say, all right, we've been here before and we came out stronger. Right. The 70s was a necessary kind of period for the West to go through a period of self-doubt. It appeared at the time when we were in it that the Soviet Union was on the march and our model was under assault. Those are my optimistic days. My pessimistic days are quite obvious what decade I think we may be in. And that's obviously the 1930s. Jamie, I surmise from your book that you think we're something closer to the 30s. Am I correct?
Well, I mean, what's different about the 70s in the negative sense is that we didn't have a leader of the free world like Donald Trump, who seems to oppose the traditional role that the United States has played in upholding the liberal world order. And also, if you want another pessimistic view of the 1930s, look, in the 1930s, you had the Anglo-American alliance basically saving Europe from destroying itself. And now we have Great Britain turning inward with Brexit, and we have Trump in Washington. And I'm not saying by any means that the situation in Europe is, you know, anything as bad as it was in the 1930s. But on that specific geopolitical, you know, question of where were the Atlantic democracies, where was the UK and the US, and what role were they playing in that period? They were playing a more constructive role in the 1930s than the US and Britain are now, I think.
Although
remember also that FDR was doing what he was doing to support the English against public opinion in his home country. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's always important to remember the power of isolationism in this country. Atlanticism is very much, well, we can argue about this, but I think Atlanticism in this country is very much an elite philosophy. I was very struck by this when I was talking to people during the presidential campaign, and I heard a lot of people talking about how, you know, they wished America would just divorce itself of all of its overseas entanglements. They saw no reason for it. Time to do nation building at home. And this was incredibly deep-seated, and Trump capitalized that on that in a way that many politicians before him have not. And you know, it's no accident that he revived this phrase, America first, which is a 1930s phrase. Mm. I mean, I see him basically as Neville Chamberlain with less intellect. That's how I see him.
Now, on the positive side, I mean, the Germany we see today, and I don't share your skepticism about Germany, Jamie. I have a bit more of an optimistic take on Germany right now. I think if we are living through the 30s, the Germans are going to be the heroes this time around. And Angela Merkel is going to be the Roosevelt and Churchill of this time. That's my, maybe it's a naive hope, but I think there's a little bit to back this up. And I'm beginning to have hope in this Franco-German alliance with Macron at the helm. The man's showing incredible leadership for somebody of his age and experience. And it seems like that this anchor could hold it together. Until hoping for the future that the U.S. will again be a strong supporter of transatlanticism and the liberal world order. Tell me I'm naive and foolish.
I agree. And one of the things I've been trying to counsel to Europeans over the past couple of weeks is that Donald Trump is not America and America is not Donald Trump. Just because he won the presidential election and he lost, by several million votes in the popular vote, despite his
3 million, yeah,
protestations to the contrary. Just because Donald Trump is president now does not mean he's going to be president forever. He might not even be president in 4 years. And so I would hedge against these sort of proclamations that, it is the end of the free world. It is the end of the transatlantic era. It could eventually come to that, but I think it's too premature to be making these kind of rash declarations right now. And I would say to Europeans, look, you have allies in Congress, you have allies in the nonprofit world. I mean, there are lots of other ways by which you can, maintain your relationship with the United States. You can work around this president. And so I think some of the proclamations that it's the, it's the death of U.S. leadership in the world, I think it's a little bit premature.
Mm-hmm. Christian, anything to add before we move on to the second part?
No, I think I agree with that. The question is, how comfortable will France and Germany be in this new role? Will they really be able to step up to the plate? I wonder. I mean, let's not forget that in the first round of the French elections, remember what Jamie said about people voting in the second round, above all against Le Pen. In the first round of the second elections, 60% of French people voted for, I think it was higher than that, I think it was 70% of voters ended up voting for pro-Kremlin candidates. Mm-hmm. So, one should, I think I am basically in agreement with the optimism, but one always has to temper it with a bit of the reality.
Okay. Well, on that, we'll move on. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and ask the question Christian raised in a recent column: is Putin still winning? I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. is Jamie Kirchick, author of the recently published book, The End of Europe: Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. And also joining us from Washington, D.C. is Christian Carl, a columnist for The Washington Post and an author of the book Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Триумф России и президента Путина.
Вмешательство российских спецслужб в американские
Лаврова с Тиллерсоном.
So Putin has suffered a series of blows recently. Germany and France have gone from being Russia's best friends in Europe to being critics. With Macron's win in France and Merkel's likely win in Germany, a revitalized Franco-German partnership looks determined to get Europe back on track. And a reset with the United States appears increasingly unlikely, at least in the short term. But in a recent column for The Washington Post, Christian, you argued not so fast. Putin is still winning, and he will continue to make mischief. For those of you that didn't read your column, Christian, I always read your columns, spell out your argument that Putin's winning and what you think we should expect going forward now. You wrote that right after Macron's win, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Well, look, if we focus on the headlines, the things that happen in the news every day, there have been some encouraging recent developments. I was extremely gratified by Macron's victory. I was profoundly encouraged by that, and I think Merkel and some of the other Germans have been showing a lot of backbone. What worries me are the underlying trends, okay? We're all so fixed on the things that have happened this week, last week, the week before. Mm-hmm. But the underlying trends are very disturbing, right? Youth unemployment is over 30% in many European countries. The European Commission appears to have no clue what to do about that, okay? The problems with migration, with immigrants, with the questions that poses to the European identity, still very much unanswered. You know, does Europe have an immigration policy? I certainly haven't noticed one. So that, I realize, doesn't answer your question. That's not about Putin so much. But my worry is that these tendencies are still going, and these fundamental trends are still going in Putin's direction. He is still showing us that he can interfere in our processes. That's why we're all sitting around here talking about him, right?
Mm-hmm. I'd be out of a job if he wasn't doing this stuff.
That's right. Those poll figures you cited about Central Europe are really astonishing, especially considering where we were 20 years ago. And then we have Donald Trump, you know, and the political chaos in the United States that whether you agree with everything that has been said about Putin or not, Putin clearly has made a contribution to this complete paralysis and internal division that we're now experiencing in Washington. So as long as that continues, I think he's a winner. How important do you think it is to him to have the United States out of the fray and consumed by its own internal problems? And at what point are we going to be fixing that? I think not anytime soon. When that changes, I'll say, you know, I can feel much more relaxed about his influence.
Yeah. No. Along those lines, Ivan Krastev had a fascinating piece in the New York Times this week, What the Russian Revolution Can Teach Us About the Rise of Trump. And I thought this was fascinating, yes. Where Ivan, as you know, just the man is brilliant. I mean, he makes this argument that Trump wasn't a Manchurian candidate, nor did I ever believe he was. But he uses the analogy of how the Germans didn't really want Lenin to take over the Russian Empire, yes, at that time. But they wanted they wanted chaos on the Eastern Front. And I think Ivan very eloquently makes this argument. Along what you said about Central and Eastern Europe, it just reminds me of just something that's truly remarkable, a trend I've noticed in the Czech Republic lately. An insult against somebody, a political insult, is to call them a Havelist. A hovelist, right?
Wow.
Now, how on earth in this country can that possibly be an insult? And I think that speaks volumes about where we are. Did you want to add something, Chris?
Yeah,
sure.
Another thing that we haven't talked about almost at all is Ukraine, right? Which is one of the biggest countries in Europe. You know, Western Europeans never think about
it. I'm glad that you framed it that way, because
Ukraine is coming apart before our eyes. Ukraine is in terrible shape. They've made a lot of progress in certain areas, but it's in dire shape. Poroshenko is in a dark place. The country has incredibly serious problems. I hear no one in Washington talking about what happens if Ukraine just collapses again, falls into complete chaos, you know. I hear no one talking about that. Ukraine is completely off the radar here. And imagine how important that is for the role of, you know, for the future of Europe. It's gigantic. I doubt anybody in Brussels is spending much time on it either.
Yeah,
the impression they are.
Ukraine is very much on my radar. And I do see some disturbing trends, but I also see some encouraging trends right now. I think sometimes we can get a little alarmist about Ukraine. I think given the circumstances, Ukraine's done quite well. I mean, it's fought the Russian army to a draw. And you have to think about that. That's remarkable.
And the sense of national identity is much stronger than it was.
Exactly.
So on and so forth.
I was in Odessa.
Like I said, they have achieved some great reforms, but the direction right now is very, very unnerving.
Well, I want to get to that, because you wrote a column about the banning of the social networking sites, and I think there's an interesting story to tell around that. I wanted to go to Jamie with something that's debated back and forth among people that watch this issue. To what extent is Putin the instigator of Europe's troubles?
Yeah.
And to what extent is he simply the beneficiary who is exploiting them?
Yeah, I think we obsess over Putin's role to our peril. I mean, Marine Le Pen would exist in France and would be popular in France if the country of Russia didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And the same goes for all of these sorts of demagogues across the Western world. Same with Trump. I think a lot of people on the left in the United States are making a big error in assuming that some evidence is going to come out proving that there was some deep collusion between the Trump campaign and Putin. Because what that sort of assumes is that the only reason that Trump could have the ideas he has, and the only reason that he could ever become president of the United States is because of the meddling of a foreign power. And I think Donald Trump, as much as I disagree with him, he represents an authentic strain
in American
of a particular
thought, yeah.
world, in American thought. And look, it's never gotten this far. It's never captured the White House, but it's always been there. You can trace it back to, you know, Andrew Jackson, whose portrait now hangs in the White House, this sort of nationalist, populist, isolationist view that takes a very unsentimental view of America's role in the world and basically looks at it as a competition of all versus all. You know, Pat Buchanan expressed this worldview when he ran for president 3 times. And so I think we need to engage with this worldview. We need to debate the people who believe in it, and we need to argue with it, and we need to deconstruct it. It's too easy just to say, oh, well, it's just, you know, it's Putin and some algorithms on Facebook that managed to, you know, elect Donald Trump. I think that's really short-sighted.
Now, that said, he is exploiting existing tensions that we're having here.
Totally. And he's great at it. I mean, this is what this is what the KGB does best.
Yeah.
They're really, really good at, you know, manipulating. And what's been remarkable in the United States is to see the Republican Party, the party of Ronald Reagan. Now you have a poll just came out showing 56% of Republicans in the United States consider Russia to be an ally of the United States. And I think the long term cultivation of the American right by Russia.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that, you know, Brian, you and I have been looking at this for
yeah.
years, but it was really under the radar. And I have to say, just a few years ago, even I assumed that this was a fringe phenomenon. I assumed it was mostly kind of paleo conservatives like, you know, like Pat Buchanan and these kind of anti-gay marriage, bitter ender types. But to now see this sort of creeping, if not affinity for Russia, then at least a sort of a new view of Russia that doesn't see it as an adversary, but as a potential partner.
Mm-hmm.
This has been one of the more remarkable developments in American politics over the past couple of years.
No, I've been looking at this and Russia's exploitation of this for a while. If you remember back in 2012, I did a piece on the Power Vertical blog about this policy paper, this white paper that was produced by the Kremlin,
yes.
arguing that these wedge issues could be exploited in the West. Now, at the time, in fairness, I saw it as more of a curiosity than anything.
Yeah.
I saw it as another crazy thing some Kremlin think tank cooked up. But
right.
they've implemented this bit by bit, and bringing the conversation back to Europe a bit, I think I know why they did this, because this kind of coincides with the period where the Kremlin began to see the EU, not so much NATO, but the EU as an existential threat, as a potential existential threat,
yeah.
because it was this model of transparent, despite its faults, a model of transparent democracy, very
right.
close to Russia's borders, not separated by an iron curtain, you know, that acted as a magnet. It was an alternative model of integration based on consensus, not coercion. And they began to see this as an existential threat and thought they could use these issues to undermine it. I wanted to get to one more. Go ahead.
And just on that exact note, people forget it was the EU that the Russians were angry about with Ukraine. It wasn't NATO. It
yeah.
was the EU association agreements that led to the Maidan and that led to the annexation of Crimea. It wasn't the potential expansion of NATO. NATO was not expanding into
yeah.
Ukraine.
Although they used that to try to spin it.
Right.
But in fact, the Kremlin strategists, when they looked at threats, they considered the EU a serious domestic political threat to this regime.
Yes.
And this was all, and if you go back to that white paper in 2012 about exploiting the far right in the West, they basically telegraphed exactly what they were going to do. Along the lines of that association agreement, I want to note that with the Dutch ratification in the Senate, the last hurdle has been cleared and that thing is happening. And I made this argument today that, you know, despite everything, Ukraine won in this sense because they are getting that association agreement once and for all. Now, there's one other trend that I've been noticing of late, and I'll throw out a few data points here. I talked about this in the blog a little bit this week as well. Moldova and Estonia have recently expelled Russian diplomats in the aftermath of major espionage cases. Estonia last month hosted the world's largest ever cyber defense exercises. Ukraine is investigating Russian internet giant Yandex for illegally collecting data on citizens. And the Ukrainian parliament is moving to restrict the activities of the Moscow Patriarchate of the Russian Orthodox Church. The Czech Republic and Finland have set up new centers to combat Russian disinformation. So despite everything we've talked about here, all of the pessimism, it seems to me, at least in Eastern Europe, governments are getting increasingly vigilant about containing Russia's mischief and its political warfare. As I suggested on the blog this week, the beginnings of a policy of non-kinetic containment are beginning to take shape. And it's interesting to watch. This is something I've long argued 70 years after George Kennan. We have to think about containment freshly. We have to think about containment in the non-kinetic, non-military sense as much as we need to think in the military sense, because Russia is at war with the West right now. They're not shooting us yet, but they certainly see themselves as at war. And to do this, we have to bring in the non-defense arms of government. You have to have a whole-of-government approach, including regulatory agencies, law enforcement. I'm seeing this in the Baltic states, and I'm seeing it to an extent in Moldova and Estonia. Christian, you wrote a column in the Post on Ukraine's banning of Russian social networking sites, which initially to a lot of us looked very alarming. I was like, my God, Poroshenko is doing a Putin imitation here, is what it looked like. Yeah. But then when you look below and they probably could have done a better job of marketing this thing. But when you look below the surface on this, when they would say, oh, OK, and they're investigating Yandex for illegal data mining of Ukrainian citizens, which is obviously being used for intelligence. When you consider that these websites or these social networking sites are all under the supervision, to put it very, very politely, of the security services, you start to think that, OK, this begins to make sense. Now, you made this argument in your column. How do you see this fitting into a larger pattern, as I just attempted to spell out?
Well, I think it is quite simply a measure of self-defense. I mean, it's something I do feel highly ambivalent about. I have a lot of friends in Ukraine who said, no, you shouldn't have said that. You know, Poroshenko is doing this as an excuse to crack down. It's just part of his larger campaign to crack down on the independent press. And you can certainly make that argument. But the argument I made in my column was had to do with the very simple point that Ukraine is under threat from a neighbor which is trying to dismember it and attack its very existence as a sovereign state. It is facing a fundamental existential threat, and social media have been shown to be a very important weapon in modern warfare, and especially in the way that Russians pursue their strategic goals. Mm-hmm. Not only have they used these social media networks to distribute all kinds, to disseminate their versions of events, often including disinformation, fake news, outright lies, but they've also used these networks to track the Ukrainian military and to track Ukrainian society and gather information on people in Ukraine. So it is something that I have to say I feel very, very ambivalent about, because it doesn't look... You know, it gives me the willies as somebody who is a strong believer in the freedom of the press. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I don't remember anybody in World War II in the United States saying that the German Reich should have the unlimited ability to communicate with American citizens during wartime, or that, you know, the German news agencies should have permission to distribute their, you know, Goebbels propaganda all over the United States. Mm-hmm. So... it's complicated, but they're at war, and you know, when you're at war and the existence of your state is up for grabs, you know, censorship, which is what this is, may play a role.
No, I agree with you on both counts, but I also see this in a kind of a broader spectrum of things that are going on. I mean, Russia's weaponized everything from organized crime to finance to business to the internet in order to undermine its neighbors and European institutions. And
I would like to say, I'd really like to see the United States and the European Union get really serious about money laundering. Mm-hmm. We've been talking for years about attacking beneficial ownership and all of these shelters, you know, places where you can hide your money overseas. We don't seem to make quite as much progress on that as I would like.
Well, I'm beginning to. Laundering terrorist money is a very serious crime above and beyond the money laundering statutes in the United States for good reason. And I'm often wondering if laundering the Kremlin's money, which a lot of banks in Europe are doing, shouldn't be considered the same way. But on the pot again, I can't help it. I try to be an optimist. I'm beginning to see, despite everything we've discussed in this program, I'm seeing things like the Czech Republic and Finland setting up centers to combat disinformation. I'm seeing the Spanish getting really serious about combating Russian organized crime. And
yeah,
I mean, organized crime, Mark Eliade just had a great report. I mean, organized crime, is, as Mark likes to say, Russia's not a mafia state. It's a state with a nationalized mafia. And that's a great little, you know, quip. But there's a lot of substance behind that, because when you look at what the way this works is organized crime operations in Europe, many of them pay essentially a tax to the FSB. To which helps them operate. What this does is it creates a черная касса. It creates a lot of black cash, untraceable, that can be used for all sorts of mischief around Europe. Now, the more governments take this whole of government approach to do this, the better off they will. We're all going to be. Jamie, how do you see? Because I see this trend going on as well with governments, even despite all of the problems you spelled out in your book. And we've discussed in this program.
Yeah. One of the more remarkable things to me is that European countries, most of them, to my knowledge, don't have bans on foreign financing in their policies.
No, that's policies. Yeah, that's a hole in the system. That's for sure.
I mean, in the United States, very lax campaign finance laws, but we're very, very stringent when it comes to foreign monetary donations to political candidates. I mean, that's a really you can go to jail for a long time if you're involved in anything like that. Whereas in France, I mean, not only did Marine Le Pen get a 9 million euro loan,
she didn't even hide
from the Russians. I mean, she didn't even hide it. You know, and no one seems to say, you know, why are foreign countries allowed to meddle like this in such a transparent and obvious fashion? I think there should be some sort of, you know, EU level provision on this, to stop foreign countries from making political donations to parties.
Now, but and I would agree with you that there's still a lot of things that need to be done, like that, for example. I'd also like to see more transparency in media ownership in Europe, because across Europe, you have all of these mysterious little websites with respectable names spewing out very pro-Kremlin positions all the time that a lot of people take seriously as serious media, and nobody knows who owns these things. Back to this black cash argument that we say that's floating around Europe, I could probably surmise where the money is coming from. But would you, despite all this, would you agree that we are starting to see movement along these lines of kind of a, what I like to call, a non-kinetic containment in Europe? It's baby steps. It's the beginning, but we're starting to see movement. Yeah. No?
There's definitely movement, but what's going to make it so difficult is that, you know, we don't want to go down to the level of the Russians on this. That's not who we are. But it makes it difficult because they fight dirty and they're really good at it, and they're polluting the internet, and they're polluting our financial systems, and they're polluting everything. And, you know, how we can form a coherent, effective response that doesn't sink to their level, I think, is one of the great challenges.
Well, I mean, I think there's ways we can do this. I mean, there's, as Edward Lucas likes to point out, a big step in the right direction would be more vigorously enforcing our own laws. That would be a huge step in the right direction. I've argued for something like a modern version of COCOM that includes things like financial instruments. You know, the old COCOM, which prevented selling things to the Soviet Union that could be used for military purposes or violation of human rights. I think this can be extended to things like financial instruments. I think there's a lot of areas that we can kind of plug the gaps here and begin to contain. It's something I've been thinking about a lot lately and want to write something on fairly soon. I hope to get it
but
out.
I think one of Jamie's points there, I think, is very important, which is we can't, you know, there's this concept in Washington that you hear about a lot, messaging, you know, somehow we can counter propagandize them. You know, we can come back with our own propaganda, you know, tell, you know, some kind of really impressive stories about how great the West is and stuff. You know, that's not really going to gain much traction. Certainly, you know, we cannot distribute fake news. You know, I think that's a very important point that Jamie makes, that we cannot descend to that level. And that makes it very tough, because we do somehow have to contain to contain the stuff they're spewing at us all the time.
Yeah, and even along those lines, though, I'd say that there are things we can do that wouldn't sink to that level of fake news or propaganda.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I do think the West
but it's
as
tough.
A whole... It's tough. No, it's definitely tough. But I think the West as a whole needs to get better at telling the Western story, which is a very, very, very compelling story that we've, you know, that's 300 years in the making, and more than 300 years, but in its current form, 300 years in the making. But, and we, you know, civilizations are just a collection of shared fictions that we believe in and become reified. And just like currency, if we stop believing in it, it stops being real. And I think this is a key component of this whole thing. I think the West needs to start believing collectively in the Western story a lot more. Now, this is tough as well, because one of the greatest strengths of the West is our ability to question and criticize ourselves and be all postmodern, right? But at the same time, I think it's one of those times where we need to reaffirm the Western story. And I think there is a way to do that without doing propaganda. Any last thoughts, guys, before we wrap it up for the week?
Let me just think. Oh, well, the British election is something I would keep a very close eye on. There are these very worrying polls. They're kind of in the minority of polls, but that show Jeremy Corbyn, who is the hard left, pro-Russian, pro-Iranian, pro-Hamas, pro-IRA leader of the Labour Party, gaining on the Tories. And this, you know, we've talked a lot about sort of, you know, political extremism today, and mostly on the right. But in Britain, it's really a problem. I see it on the left. And the hijacking of the Labour Party by the hard left is really a tragedy. So that's something to keep an eye on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the last poll I saw shows a hung parliament, actually, the YouGov poll. Anything you want to add, Christian?
Well, I just want to add again about this point that, yeah, you know, Putin hasn't made all this up. He's exploiting our own weaknesses. He is playing off existing problems. And I agree with Jamie that we cannot act if, you know, if we somehow neutralize Putin as a factor, everything will be great. We need to go back and take a fundamental look at where our own societies are headed. We need to regain that sense of what's important to save about the West. And we need to get our own act in order. You know, we need to get our own affairs in order. And that is the best defense we can possibly think of.
Okay, well, I like that. We can wrap it up on an optimistic note. On that note, we'll wrap it up for today. I'd like to remind you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Washington, D.C. has been Jamie Kirchick, author of the recently published book, The End of Europe, Dictators, Demagogues, and the Coming Dark Age. I got my copy. You should all get yours. Also joining us from Washington, D.C. has been Christian Carl, a columnist at the Washington Post and an author of the book Strange Revels, 1979, and The Birth of the 21st Century. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.